It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The Skipjack. There used to be hundreds plowing the waters of Chesapeake Bay. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Some say there were originally 600 skipjacks built along the bay since the early 1890s. Others suggest 1,000. Some claim up to 2,000. Those are the words of local columnist Bryce Stump in his new book, Working Skipjacks of Deal Island. They are a unique vessel with their ability to plumb the waters of the bay and its tributaries, and that they're best known for scooping up the oyster. Well, we have Bryce in our studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don.
So what inspired you to do this book?
I've been taking pictures of skipjacks since 1979. And I was hoping to put out a book of skipjack photos that covered that time period from 79 to the present. And I needed some contemporary photographs as of last year. So I went back to Deal Island, started to take some pictures, and realized that this was an opportunity to do a book specifically on skipjacks today. And I found out that there is no other definitive skipjack book on the market. There may be five. You'd be hard-pressed to find five skipjack books. I was quite surprised with that. So I decided to do a book on the Deal Island skipjacks. It was convenient for me to get to. I had the time and I had the talent to do this project, and I thought that historically it needed to be done.
How important do you think it is to preserve this this heritage? Particularly, you've done it obviously through a book, but there used to be, as you indicated a moment ago, maybe 600, 1,000, so on. Now there's what, maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen?
Yeah, the number fluctuates, Don.
Yeah.
people seem to think that there's still 100 skipjacks out there, but there's not. There's probably 12 that is still working the bay, dredging oysters. And the number, it's hard to pin down a number because it fluctuates. Some of the vessels are taken out of service. Some are rebuilt. Some are restored. So consequently, there's always a little bit of a fluctuation in the numbers, but probably 12 working skipjacks today. I believe 6 to 8 are in Deal Island. It's probably the home port to the largest remaining fleet that has come down from 600, 1,000, 2,000
right.
down to a dozen or so. Deal Island is sort of unique in that it has always maintained its skipjack fleet locally. A lot of the boats, some of the boats that come down to Deal Island now are from Tillman and from Cambridge. They come down to work the oyster grounds. And consequently, they may overwinter in Deal Island and go back to their home ports in spring. But the Deal Island skipjacks have traditionally worked out of Deal Island, particularly in recent years. So as oyster grounds are closed, as oyster grounds are opened, as some are depleted, as some are rebounding, that determines where the oyster skipjack fleet calls home. So in this particular case, because of Tangier Sound being a good working oyster ground, that's where the boats are.
So now there are not really a whole lot of working skipjacks left. I mean, why is it we have this? I mean, obviously there's some changes in the laws and powerboats and that kind of thing. Why we have seen this diminishment, do you think? I mean, what happened? Because as you said, there certainly – in fact, I was talking to Stoney Whitelock a number of years back, and he said as a kid, he could remember looking out of the harbor, and there were like hundreds. I mean, just all these masts out there. Now it's kind of disappeared.
Well, I guess it's not unlike some aspects of agriculture when practices change.
Mm-hmm.
We used to plow fields. Now we don't plow fields. We used to do a lot of disking. We don't do disking. There used to be a lot more tomato fields. It's a matter of the labor force. These boats, Don, are very expensive to maintain and to build. $500,000 to build a new skipjack.
Mm.
$375 was spent restoring the Catherine, which is featured on the cover of the book. With that kind of a financial outlay, you have to have the return on the oysters to support the boats. And that is not happening today for a lot of reasons. The state is increasingly setting aside oyster grounds that are not available to the to the skipjacks and to watermen in general. And because it costs so much to maintain the skipjacks, they have got to have the oysters. And that's not the case. I think last year they were getting 50, 60 bushels. Before that, they were getting perhaps 100, 120, 130. I believe they're allowed 150 a day. And skipjacks are unique. They are allowed to go 2 days a week with sail power, 2 days a week with the yaw boat or push boat power. They are not allowed to have sole propulsion system on board the boat. Because the traditional way of dredging was with sail power, they have 2 days sail, 2 days power. Unfortunately, over the years, the number of men on the crew who are familiar with working with sail power has diminished considerably. And the sad news is there isn't a crew on Dio Island that can work dredging under sail power alone.
Is that population, by the way, aging in terms of the people who, A, do this sort of thing, the use of skipjack, and B, I mean, is the younger generation, do you get a sense, is moving out of this and finding other avenues of work? Because, obviously it's fairly tough, a tough industry in terms of it's tough work. I mean, it's not as lucrative perhaps as it was before. I mean, do we see that population aging in terms of people who can actually do this kind of work, you think?
Well, Don, that's a good question. The kind of work it is demands young people, not older people. Is the pool there? It's decreasing. Do people want to do this kind of work? Well, obviously no. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but if they can go out 2 days a week with sail power, 2 days a week with push power, and they only opt to go out with the push power, then they are not motivated to go out with sail power. This means that if they're making, if they're taking in 100, 150 bushels a day and they're getting $50 per bushel, they can double their paycheck by going out with 2 days of sail, but they don't do it. It's tricky. It's old school. It's slower than the push boat. They've got to turn around. They've got to depend on the tide and the wind to work in their favor. Yes, it's tricky. And the young crowd, the young crew does not really want to do that. As far as the pool of workers, the crew, they're okay. It's just getting the right person that wants to do this kind of work. The men are out there, Don. It's just whether or not they want to work on a skipjack. It's cold. And it might surprise your listeners to know that skipjack crewmen do not have workman's compensation. They do not have health insurance. They do not have vacation. They do not have sick days off. They are subcontractors. And they are paid in cash each day that they work. So that's the appeal to the men, that they can get paid when the day is done. But as far as, is it the crew that's the crew, so the crew pool, mm-hmm, that's limiting the skipjacks? No, I don't think that's really a factor. I think if they were catching a lot of oysters and they were able to go out the full 4 days, that it would be a stronger industry. But because the boats are so expensive and the crews, the makeup of the crew is what it is, this can't go on forever.
Did you think it'll disappear?
Oh, yes. I think a lot of the skipjack captains are in the impression, too, that this cannot last forever.
Do you think that we will lose something culturally when that does? I mean, are we losing it now, do you think? Because one of the things that, by the way, that's always struck me about particularly the watermen, and I come from the West, I come from Los Angeles and so on, they remind me of the cowboy who had his horse and he roamed the ranges. He had jobs. He was independent. And it seems to me that watermen are maybe similar in the sense that they're very independent. They have their boat. They got their crew. And they really work as individuals. But do you think we will lose that culture as this disappears?
Well, I think you're absolutely right about the individuality or the individualism of what this is. The men can decide to go out or not.
Right.
I was down to the island a couple of days ago, and I found that some of the crew were short. I found that some of the guys I saw in one boat one day were on another boat the next day because they're filling in the gaps and trying to go out. When one boat does and when one boat doesn't, the crews shift back and forth. The individualism, and you asked me why this is important to the Eastern Shore, I believe that this is the last working piece of living history that is unchanged probably for a century. These men on these boats basically do the same thing they did in 1890. And I don't know any other industry or job on the Eastern Shore that does this. We used to have canning houses, a way of life that was around for almost a century. Strawberry field picking, a certain culture and class there. But this cannot go on forever. And I think it's important to have photographed it. What is special about this book is it gives the person like you, the come here.
Right, I got it.
The come here, the opportunity to see a skipjack other than just once a year under sail at the annual skipjack race. People, I guess, Don, have told me that they've been around skipjacks a lot of their life and did not realize or see the perspectives in this book of skipjack life. Even though they were familiar with the skipjacks, this brought a brand new eye-opening perspective about what these guys and what these boats do for a living. Dredging is very hard on these wooden boats. It is dangerous. I think a guy just this week had a dredge fall on his foot, put him out of commission. And when he's out of commission, he's out of commission.
Not making money.
He's not making money, and I don't know who absorbs the medical cost on this, how he's going to manage on his own. Family here at Christmas, kind of dependent on him. So, yes, it certainly is a water cowboy way of life to a degree that they're certainly individual guys. There's no doubt about that. And I think that what appeals to me is that these guys are who they are. They're hardworking men. They've got challenges, life challenges, just like the rest of us do, just in different ways. So I believe that this book documents and preserves a way of life that has really been overlooked, that there is no other definitive book on skipjacks was surprising because the boat is the official Maryland boat since 1985. And I thought there was a lot of competition out there. It wasn't even my intention, Don, to initially go in this, let's publish a book. It was to get a portfolio of pictures and decide what to do with that portfolio. But I think it's important. In this book, every single individual is named and identified. So often in these publications, magazines, newspapers, books, promotionals, advertisements, they overlook the guys who make all this possible. And they're important to this. They are the ones who make this happen. And I want every guy to be recognized for the achievements or the contributions they make to going out and having a good day on the bay.
I want to turn to couple of the boats. One, my favorite is, of course, the Catherine. I've actually been on a number of times. Stony Whitelock was the one who owns it and has fixed it up. I guess it was actually built in 1901. Tell me a little bit about this particular boat.
The Catherine's a beautiful boat. And then, as I told you just prior to starting this interview, just because I did the interview, just because I did the book of photographs, 650 photographs in this book, I'm still learning as I go, Don. There's all facets to this skipjack project. Building it, maintaining it, working on it, photographing it, each little thing here has its specialty. I am not that familiar with the technical aspects of the boat, this construction, what makes them each one of them so different and unique.
Right.
But the Catherine is the featured skipjack in this book, not because of any there's no reason, I guess what I'm saying, that I made the Catherine the prominent featured skipjack in the book, only other than I went out on the Catherine and I did a day in the life of a skipjack. And the Catherine is from daybreak to returning, calling it a day at the end of the workday and in the harbor. That is representative of the life on the skipjacks, of all the skipjacks working the bay. Same procedure on all the boats. So I didn't want to devote telling the same story eight times. There's only so many ways you can take pictures of people calling right. oysters on their knees. And there are certain aspects of photography that where individual to each boat. But the Catherine is a representative boat. The other boats or the other skipjacks in the book certainly show photographic scenes, but not as detailed as the Catherine because it is what it is.
One of the things, by the way, that struck me about the photographs and actually reading now a novel about a waterman and his daughter actually on the Western Shore. But one of the things that struck me about the photographs, and I don't think you realize it if you just simply go out, is the visual images of them pulling these big, gigantic nets up. I mean, sometimes I guess they have – I mean, they have certainly what they call winders, I guess, to pull them up by motor. But nonetheless, I mean, sometimes they break down. But it's a remarkable thing about how they're able to reach down. What was that like when you saw them do that?
Well, back to what I just said about a number of people who have worked around skipjacks but were unfamiliar with what really goes on a skipjack,
yeah.
including some of the people who work at the harbor. They did not know what these guys do out on these boats other than they just show up with oysters on
right.
deck. So, Don, the wanders that you mentioned are 100 years old. They are recycled from old skipjack to old skipjack. They are motor-driven, motor-powered dredge winders. They have a certain simplicity and nostalgic appeal and a familiarity that really is endearing. Even if you're not familiar with the workings of a skipjack, there's something simple and just neat about these winders because they are so darn simple. They either pull the cable in or they let the cable out.
Right.
That's basically what they do. But that they've been around for 100 years shows that simple works. Now, on the back of the book, you talked about the size
of
the dredges. On the back of the book is a picture of three 18-year-old guys pulling in a dredge by hand on the city of Crisfield last winter, the winter of 2016. The motor, the gears in the winder broke. They had no ability to pull up the dredge. The dredge can weigh about 500 to 700 pounds.
Wow.
It was 75 feet below the boat. The steel cable is about the size of your little finger. So there is a way to pull up the dredge using the halyards on the skipjack, the lines that are used in the sails. For some reason, Captain Stan Daniels didn't opt to use that recourse. I don't know whether the lines were entangled or they weren't safe for this. I don't know. But the three boys pulled up the dredge by hand. It was a very exhausting project because they had 75 feet of cable to coming on board with nowhere to put it. It's also interesting to know that even though these boats look really nice and big when you're looking at them sailing the bay and you're up close, there is only 5 feet of working space between the winder and the side of the boat. The boat's only 15 feet wide. Winders take up about 5 feet, so at least the guy's 5 feet on each side. So the guys were standing where the dredge should be, pulling up the dredge itself. And then they had to go down to the other side of the boat and pull that one up so they could get back to port. Ed Farley from Easton, Talbot County, is photographed in the book. He's not a working, he's not a working skipjack captain from Deal Island. He is from Tillman or the Talbot area. And he is the man that all the folks, all the captains go to when they need parts or to replace their winders. Ed kind of keeps an eye out for these recycled winders. You don't go to Lowe's or Home Depot and buy a winder for a skipjack.
You get an old one.
Yes, sir. You get an old one. Now the Mini V, which is Stoney's newest boat,
right,
has a hydraulic system on it, which photographically is quite a departure from these old winders. I'd much rather be on the boat that had the traditional winder system on it. I think the crews like it better because they're so simple to use. Go ahead.
So when you're out there, when you were out there sailing, what was that like for you? And I don't mean in the sense of the, just the individual, you know, goings on, but is there a connectiveness, do you think, to being out there on the water like that? I mean, you get that emotional feel of, you know, what it's to be out there.
I think that's a good point. When you're out on a working skipjack, it's just you, the boat, and the crew. Your problems are on the shore. You're out there back to nature, so to speak. There are no distractions. You're doing what you're doing. You can observe the sky, the clouds, the water, the waves, the smell of the setting, feel the coldness. The winder engine makes a considerable amount of noise, as does the push boat. And it sort of becomes almost melodic to a degree. The guys certainly are used to it. Yes, there is a certain appeal. And to your earlier question about the cultural importance of the preservation of this, very few people will ever have the opportunity to go out on the bay on a working skipjack and experience the same kind of a lifestyle that was experienced in 1890. It's neat. I think in the book I quoted one of the guys saying that if they hadn't gone out today, they would have been home fighting or arguing with their girlfriend. And out here, it's just all the guys and working the bay.
By the way, we should note, by the way, the passing of Art Daniels. He was a skipjack for a long time. What kind of loss do you think for the bay? Somebody who was so prominent and spent so much time. I know his sons, I guess, are now out. And I think you certainly worked with him when you were taking these photographs.
For clarification, his last name is Daniel.
Right. Okay.
And this is in the book. I had to point this out a number of times. His children and his grandchildren spell it with an S. He spells it without an S.
Ah. Okay.
So, and I lapse back and forth just like everyone else does. He was unique, Don, in that he was one of the few watermen who had a really good rapport with the press. Even from the 60s, he was approachable, he was knowledgeable, he was gregarious, he was accommodating. He was just the ideal person to go to when you had a skipjack-related question or you wanted to do a skipjack-related project. He was extremely knowledgeable because he went so far back. I believe he was 94, 95 when he died. He went so far back that he grew up knowing the people who had been on some of the earliest skipjacks. So that's they brought a lot to him. They told him skipjack stories of the crews, of the captains of the boats where they were built, what goes into the making of a good captain and a good boat and a good crew. So yes, he knew all the little nuances that just made for great listening, great reporting, and a very knowledgeable source of the skipjacks that were. A lot has changed in the way the skipjacks are handled today. They use a lot of the lumber that's been treated. Treated lumber.
Treated lumber, yeah.
Treated lumber for restoration in the skipjacks. And back in his day, people were still looking for the ideal tree
right.
for the mast and this kind of stuff, yeah. And the wood, the secondary woods on the skipjack. So, yes, I personally miss him because if I wanted to know about what was life like during the Depression for a waterman's family on Deal Island, he could tell me. And I am so grateful that I had the opportunity and the foresight to ask him as many questions as I could, knowing that his time on Earth, like all of us, is limited. And I did not want to go back and say, gee, I wish I'd asked them this. I wish I had asked them that. So I asked him every conceivable question about every aspect of life that about the watermen and skipjacks that I could have done. And I'm really glad I did. On the back is his son, Stan, taken in March of 2016, and now Stan is almost on his deathbed with dementia and health problems. So Daddy Art's gone. I think we've lost 7 people in this book in a year. So I'm glad I did this at the right time. This project, even from its inception, was meant to be. I know that sounds mystical, but it was. That I soon came to realize that so many things were going right in my favor that it was beyond coincidence. I was sort of got goosebumps reflecting on this. Everything went right in this book, and I don't believe I've ever been involved in a project in my 36-year career with the Daily Times. We go out on weekly assignments.
Sure.
Things go wrong, even with you.
Right.
But this was different. This was month after month after month of work, and everything went right.
And you, by the way, we also should mention that all of the photographs are in black and white, or they look a little sepia-toned, actually, from at least from some of the lighting. Why did you decide to choose that particular medium?
Okay. Talking about things going right, this picture that you see on the back cover of the guys pulling in the dredge by hand has never been photographed before. I just happened to be at the right place at the right time with the right captain.
Right.
And you cannot take skipjack pictures like this on the boat. That was even more important. Had I been on the boat, I would have seen any of this. So I'm glad I was on another boat, but it was an opportunity that has never afforded itself to another photographer. Go back to your question again.
Right. About these, and then these are in black and white.
Okay. These pictures are in black and white for a very specific reason. For much of the heyday of the skipjack, they were always photographed, particularly in newspapers, in black and white. Some of the books that are out there today have black and white photographs in them. But I wanted the photograph to tell the story. I did not want things to compete with your eye. I did not want the yellow antifreeze jug or the Pepsi Cola can or the red life preserver or the white tub to take your eye away from the action. And in the beginning of the book, I have a little story from photographer restorationist Mike Day here in Salisbury, who had a preservation image business for a number of years doing work for the Smithsonian and other key museums across the nation. And there is a special art form to black and white. And I'm really delighted that people, when they pick up this book, they know what they've got in their hands and they'll say, oh, I'm so glad it's in black and white. I love black and white. And black and white just tells it differently, the story and the mood. Your eye goes right to what's going on. It isn't distracted or watered down by color. So that's why black and white. It was a task, surprisingly, to get black and white right. This is full color.
Yep.
Let's try it again. This is full 4-color printing. The process is just identical to color printing. It's just as expensive, and here it is.
Sounds like this was a labor of love.
Yes, it was a labor of love, but I sort of obligated myself to taking and setting up a deadline to get this put out.
Always
and
good.
Yes, well, yes, that encouraged you to meet a certain deadline. But it's like anything else. The production end of it isn't quite the same as the artistic, the fun part of
right.
putting a book together. There was challenges in getting it done. There are typos in the book. I admit that. It isn't for a want of trying. Oh, we had problems getting the book printed in black and white, and those spelling errors got back in the book. But as one man told me, Bryce Stump readers aren't concerned about a few typos, which is very kind. So it isn't about there's 60,000 words and captions. Mm-hmm. There's a few stories. The book is about the pictures and life out on the Chesapeake Bay with a skipjack.
Well, I have to admit, they're absolutely gorgeous. I mean, the way they're all laid out and the printing is, I might say that to listeners, the printing of the book and these photographs are extremely good. It's, you know, sometimes you'll find photographic books that aren't. This really does the trick. Well, we appreciate you stopping by. We've been talking with Bryce Stump with his new book, Working Skipjacks of Deal Island, and we encourage people to contact him. By the way, can they get the book?
I'm glad you asked that.
Doug, now that I think about it, because
I want the listeners to know that this is a self-published book,
right?
Not unlike a lot of books that are out on the market, and that's because the people out in the Midwest, is that where you're from?
The West. California guys.
California guys may not be interested in skipjacks.
Well, they should be.
A major publishing house goes by the demographics.
Okay. So where can they get?
So self-published. It is available through my website, My Shore History, all one word, mm-hmm. myshorehistory.com. It's available at Barb's Hallmark in the Twilley Shopping Center in Salisbury. Lucky's store on Chance, mm-hmm. down there near Deal Island, Scott's Cove Marina, and now the News Center in Easton, mm-hmm. and the Dorchester County Historical Society in Cambridge. And Don, I try to make this book available locally to benefit the Skipjack Heritage Foundation Museum, to benefit the Tickle Mansion in Princess Anne, because the books that are sold at Somerset Choice Antiques in Princess Anne, they are solely responsible for the operating budget of the mansion, and this book sale at their shop helps them achieve that goal. And I want the money to stay local. I do not want this to be in big bookstores. It is not going to be in Amazon. It is not going to be in Barnes & Noble. It's going to be available to the local business communities or organizations that can benefit from the sale of this book.
Well, appreciate you stopping by. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
The battle over pharmaceutical drug pricing has come to the state of Maryland. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Maryland has enacted a law that prohibits price gouging for generic and off-patent brand-name drugs. It has already been challenged by a group representing makers of generic prescription drugs who argue that it is an unconstitutional overreach that will create market instability. Supporters of the measure note that the cost of some generics have skyrocketed. We caught up with three panelists at a forum of supporters held in Salisbury this week. In attendance was State Senator Jim Mathias, Vincent DeMarco, president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative, and Tammy Bresnahan with AARP. Welcome to the program.
So, Vincent, tell me then a little bit about the significance of this price gouging law and the fact, obviously, that it's also being challenged as well.
Well, thanks so much, Don, for having us on the show. Maryland is the first state in the country to ban price gouging by manufacturers of generic and off-patent prescription drugs. For the last few years, Marylanders and Americans have been suffering because these folks have been raising prices astronomically on desperately needed drugs, sometimes up to 5,000%. And before this year, no one was doing anything about it. Well, the Maryland General Assembly did something about it and passed this law, which authorizes our Attorney General to take legal action to block unconscionable price increases by prescription drug manufacturers of generic and off-patent drugs. This law took effect on October 1. And yes, the drug corporations don't like it, and they went to court to try to block it. Very, very unfortunate that they did that. But the Attorney General Frosch has defeated them in federal district court, and now it's on appeal. to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. There'll be a hearing in late January. We're confident that the Attorney General will succeed and the law will be in place. But it is in effect now. And what we at the Maryland Healthcare for All Coalition are asking is that if you are someone who's been hurt by skyrocketing prescription drug prices, go to our website, healthcareforall.com/hearmystory. And in English or Spanish, you could tell your story of how prescription drug prices have hurt you. And possibly it could be a case where the Attorney General's office could make them stop. This is very, very important. And I can also tell you, Don, that we've been hearing from states all across the country who are going to follow in our footsteps because this is such an important new measure. And nobody else has been able to do it. And we're thrilled that Senator Jim Mathias is here because he was one of the leaders on the Senate Finance Committee in making this happen. And it couldn't have happened without the support of AARP. AARP, of course, nationally, one of the leaders in making health care more available for Marylanders and Americans. And they were at the forefront with us in getting this law passed.
Now, let me ask you this, Vincent. One of the critiques of this law is that the opponents say that targets the wrong drugs, that it's, in terms of off-patent brand names as well as generic as opposed to big pharma brand names. What's wrong with that critique?
Well, first of all, they're both problems, and we focused on what we could focus on in the 2017 session. And there's a new study out by top leaders in Congress showing that manufacturers of generic and off-patent drugs are raising their prices astronomically. We're not giving up on brand name drugs. We're looking at that. And we did have a piece of legislation last year which didn't pass, which would have required all drug manufacturers to disclose the basis of their high-priced drugs. So in the 2018 session, we'll think about what we could do about brand name drugs. But in 2017, we focused on what we could do. We were hearing from people who had EpiPens, which are parents need for their kids who are allergic, or naloxone, another drug which is generic that first providers need to help, first responders need to help people who are having opioid disasters. These drugs have skyrocketed recently in price. These are the kind of generic drugs that we need to do something about, and the Maryland General Assembly took action where it could.
Went to you, Senator. So what about this terms of what kinds of drugs are targeted, and why did the legislation lay out the way that it did in terms of how it ultimately was drawn up?
Well, thank you, Don. First of all, I've had the life experience in being involved with chronic illness, caregivers and the like, and this is critically important to people in our district. And when you start to talk about the type of drugs, talk about antibiotic drugs, drugs that manage your asthma, after-surgery drugs, migraines, high cholesterol drugs, high blood pressure drugs. And we all know about the opioid and heroin issue with naloxone and the like. These are everyday drugs. And, I heard that a critic may say, what about the name brand drugs? But, look at the market. When a drug goes off patent, people leave the market allegedly because of the margin, the price margins, and it only leaves a few manufacturers, and it leaves them to the will of raising these prices unconscionably. When you turn and you look, this isn't something that's new, but we are a leader here in Maryland. This is why we took the first step. This is the first state that has gone with this price gouging. And just take a moment. When you look at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, they did a study. And they found over 300 drugs of the type that I just explained to you that had these skyrocketing price increases. And these increases held for a year or more. We are here now. Tell your story. That's what we're here for today, is to tell your story so that we can make sure that our attorney general can take the opportunity to protect our citizens. When we hear from AARP, Tammy's going to talk to you about a very high percentage of some of these folks' annual income is to their drug prices. And when they spike like this, we stepped up. We did exactly what was necessary. That's why Maryland is a leader in healthcare. I was recently appointed to the Maryland Caregivers Commission. And that's critically important. All of us at some point in our life are caregivers to the ones that we love. When we're integrated in our community, we hear these stories. There are stories that affect whether you make choices about it. You get your drugs, you don't get your drugs, and clearly, and tell your story. And with the leadership we have here in Maryland, we're here to do something about it, and we have. So that's why I took the leadership action that I did.
You, Senator, have your own personal story with your wife. Did you see this kind of problem with pricing in terms of the kinds of drugs that were being prescribed, particularly for something as life-threatening, I believe it was cancer?
Well, maybe not specifically in our case, but right. I could tell you in other groups. You know, God bless Kathy. She was a founder of the Worcester County American Cancer Society. You know, they have outreach and help. So, yeah, there are folks out there that were, first of all, couldn't get what they needed at times because of the pricing. But, you know, when you have that amalgam of relationships, not only in your immediate family but throughout your community, yes, I've heard it, I've seen it, and that's why I took action about it.
By the way, and finally, what kind of lobbying did you see in Annapolis about this? Did you see a lot of pushback in terms of not getting this law?
Well, quite frankly, we did have our committee hearings, and but I, you know, all I could tell you is overwhelmingly, our people, the citizens that we represent here on the Eastern Shore and throughout the state, support this bill. Perhaps maybe there were some special interests, but clearly, you know, my vote is always with our people and looking out for their best interests. So this was a clear choice for me.
Tell me, I want to turn to you because there's. These affect certainly people who are getting older, because the older that you get, the more drugs you seem to need in one fashion or another. How do you see this impacting the elderly?
So, as you say, the biggest user of prescription drugs are people over 65. And what we're seeing is people having to make a choice because they have limited incomes. You know, the average Social Security payment in Maryland is about $1,200 a month. And when, in some cases, we just released a study on one prescription drug in 2015 was three times the average cost for widely used prescription drugs, which is equal to about $12,951 a year. So people are having to make a choice. ARP has been at the forefront of prescription drugs because Medicare is the only health insurance program that is not allowed by statute to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies. All the other companies, your Care First, your Blue Cross, Kaiser, they all can negotiate. But when it comes to the people that need drugs the most, they're prohibited. So that is one of the issues that AARP has been in the forefront on. We also know that people have to make these choices, whether to live or die. Just last week, I was talking to an individual, an insulin product, insulin, which has been on the market for over 50 years. You know, she had to pay in $400 for one prescription. And this is with a Medicare card. And while some people might not see this because they're insured or they have Medicare and a supplemental, we do see the cost of health insurance going up. And one of the drivers of the whole cost of the health insurance in this country are prescription drugs.
Because one of the things that strikes me is that when Medicare was first created, people did not anticipate that drugs would be a significant component. Obviously, things have been added, including Part D. How significant is that shift going on in terms of the kind of costs that people face, particularly the people who are over 65 who are eligible for Medicare?
Well, it's astronomical, and people did not realize. I mean, when you talk about a generic drug, we always thought that that was something that cost not as much as, you know, a name brand drug. So people were more inclined to get a generic drug. So they have had to shift their monies. They've had to shift their retirements and just to survive, because these are life-saving drugs. I mean, what Vinny said, the gouging bill was focused on drugs that keep people alive, the EpiPen, insulin, high blood pressure drugs, you know, people that have high cholesterol. So we have been focusing on drugs that will keep people alive so that they can afford them.
Vince, I want to ask you, so why is it we're seeing this situation where we're having high prices for generic drugs? I mean, a lot of people are pointing towards consolidation, because obviously we think about big pharma and brand names, that kind of thing. Most people assume that we'll just have little pharma. We'll go out there and compete.
Well, we all heard the story of Martin Shkreli, an equity fund guy, a banking guy, who decided to buy a company that made this drug that was really critical for people with toxic illnesses. And he said, well, I'm going to buy that drug and then raise the price by 5,000%. Astronomically high, out of the reach of many people. He was testifying before Congress, and someone asked him, well, why did you do that? And he said, because I can. And that was just horrible, that he was able to buy this company and zoom up the price and take money from people who needed that drug, as Tammy said, making decisions on giving up things they needed because they had to stay alive. Well, know what? In Maryland, he can't anymore. People can't do that anymore in Maryland because of this law. And that's why we really thank AARP, Senator Mathias, and the Maryland General Assembly for enacting this life-saving law. The fact of the matter is generics were supposed to be, as Tammy said, much cheaper. But when you got someone like Shirelli being able to buy a company and zoom up the prices, that's not right. And we've done something about it here.
Senator, is this something that can be really addressed at a state on a state level, or do we think we need to look at something more national?
Well, clearly we have to take action now. When I hear my constituents here on the Eastern Shore, absolutely, we have it in our hands, as you can see with this bill. This bill passed all the constitutional muster, so we need to act now. We need to act locally. Now, I certainly encourage the administration federally, our federal delegation, to take the same action here as they move forward. So, but I am very proud of Maryland as we've stepped forth in a statewide initiative.
Tammy, what about you? Is this something that needs to be nationally addressed? I mean, can states really do this on, or are we going to be find ourselves caught up in court battles and some of this stuff's going to drag on for a while? I mean,
I think it's a bifurcated path. I think that the states have to show that they're not willing to put up with this, and that we have to work on the national level, which we're doing.
And let me add, Don, about 30 states, legislators about 30 states are looking at replicating this law. So it is spreading around the country.
I want to ask you about something else, since I have you in the studio. That is, of course, the Affordable Care Act. And it's been suggested that on a national level, we've seen a rolling back, maybe a transformation of the Affordable Care Act, weakening some of its provisions, for instance, whether it's work requirements, for instance, to get Medicaid, or elimination perhaps of the individual mandate. We'll see how that works out in the Senate. To you, Vince, first. Is the Affordable Care Act being slowly dismantled, do you think, or is it going to be changed in such a way to make it more efficient? What's your sense about what's going on that national level?
Well, first of all, let me just say, everyone should know this. The Affordable Care Act is a huge success in America and in Maryland. Over 400,000 people have gotten enrolled. And, you know, we thank the Hogan administration for working really hard to keep it going. The exchange has worked better. This open enrollment going on now is one of the best we've ever had. This is bipartisan and it's working. And people, if you're not enrolled, the deadline is December 15th, a couple of days. Go to MarylandHealthConnection.gov and enroll. So the Affordable Care Act is working. There are issues which need to be addressed. Unfortunately, there are people in Washington who are trying to destroy the Affordable Care Act. That's why, thanks to Senator Mathias, the Maryland General Assembly, they created what's called the Maryland Health Insurance Coverage Commission. And I'm on that commission. It's a bipartisan commission, a group of 19 of us, who are working on figuring out, well, what could we do in Maryland to protect Maryland from anything they do in Congress or in the Trump administration to undermine the Affordable Care Act. I want to just emphasize something. We are bipartisan. The Maryland Health Insurance Coverage Protection Commission, we're going to propose bipartisan solutions. Governor Hogan joined 10 other governors in writing letters to Congress opposing repeal of the Affordable Care Act, opposing weakening it. We look forward to working with him to enact measures in Maryland to make sure that if weakening happens, it doesn't affect Maryland.
Senator, how does the state react if indeed we find some of these things rolled back, particularly any kind of, say, for instance, any of the subsidies, any of the compensation in federal funds, Medicaid, for instance, if that's cut back? Is the state in a position to try to
deal with those kinds of things.
Well, that's why we have the commission, that we're anticipating that. You see this moving federally. Every day when people wake up or at night when they go to bed, people with this coverage that they've been able to gain by the Affordable Care Act, they're anxious.
Right.
They're concerned. You know, you looked at that vote at 2 o'clock in the morning this summer with Senator McCain. We applaud him as a hero. And I say thank you to Governor Hogan for saying, do not repeal this. So what are we doing? Maryland, again, is a leader in health care. As we were with price gouging, we have been. We rolled out the exchange. As Vinny has said, please, folks, if you haven't reached out for coverage, do by December the 15th. Early detection, when you have preventive screenings and all with your health care, it really certainly prevents a more catastrophic illness down the road. That's what Maryland has always been about. Long before the Affordable Care Act, we had MHIP and MCHIP and all the things with the insurer of last resort. So we have been a leader in health care. Certainly as when I was a younger person, and I just happen to be a little more wise now, my elders then said, Jim, if you have your health, you have everything. This helps protect your health. The Affordable Care Act has helped protect your health. We're here to protect the Affordable Care Act through the exchanges, and I encourage folks that have not reached out for insurance yet to please do. It's in their long-term best health care interest.
Vince, one of the things that struck me, by the way, and I've been at a number of events now with Congressman Andy Harris, and obviously he wants to repeal it, but one of the things he talks about is he wants to replace all of that and do it at the state level, and he speaks very highly of the high-risk pools. What's your assessment of those pools and how they worked in the past?
Well, with all due respect, states can't put up the kind of money necessary to do what the Affordable Care Act does. And that is why Governor Hogan, Governor Kasich of Ohio, another Republican, and so many Republican governors said, do not undermine Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. States just don't have the ability to raise that kind of money. As Governor Hogan said, if those horrible bills had passed, Maryland would have lost $2 billion. Where would we have found that money? Nowhere. It would have meant hundreds of thousands of people without the kind of critical health care coverage the senator is talking about. States cannot do this, but states can build on it. And that's what we're going to do through the Health Insurance Coverage Protection Commission.
How significant, by the way, is the individual mandate, which looks like it's on the chopping block? We'll see whether
it is critical, Don. It is critical because simply you can't. One of the things people really love about the Affordable Care Act is that if you have a pre-existing condition, you can't be denied health care. Yeah. And that's very, very important. But you can't have that and not require everybody to do their fair share. It just has to both happen. So one of the things we at the Healthcare for All Coalition are going to be advocating for is to protect the individual mandate in Maryland. And we released a poll showing that the overwhelming majority of Marylanders support that. The overwhelming majority of Marylanders know the individual mandate is critical and they want it protected here in Maryland.
Tammy, I want to turn to you because one of the things that comes out of the tax bill, if indeed it does pass, is that there'll be large tax cuts, which means that more than likely it'll be less revenue. And people are already talking about automatic cuts in, say, Medicare or Medicaid. Medicaid, by the way, should emphasize a lot of the older people use it simply because they need long-term care. That's one of the keys, one of the biggest chunks there. What kind of impact do you think that would be if suddenly we had to start cutting back?
So 3/4 of our Medicaid population are in a long-term care facility. And so that in itself, it's not, you know, children, it's older people who have given their best to Maryland. And we know that there were provisions in the Affordable Care Act and now what's being discussed on Capitol Hill that firmed up Medicare. And now they're talking about automatic cuts, and that's going to hurt our older population, as well as our most vulnerable population. We know that the Affordable Care Act built into its more people that were covered from Atlantic General to Kent General. Those hospitals supported the Affordable Care Act because they had less people coming through the door without coverage. And now, you know, there's, you know, Vinny said 450,000 Marylanders with coverage. And we know that what they're doing on Capitol Hill will only destabilize the economy and the health market. So we at AARP have sent letters to all of the leaders, both the minority and the majority leaders, as well as to the president, saying, you know, be careful not to cut Medicare. You're going to hurt your most vulnerable populations and the people that have given their most to this country.
So go just briefly, start with you, Vince. Are you optimistic that we're going to get keep the Affordable Care Act in place, that you're going to be able to move forward with some kind of a better health care? I mean, we've got an administration, obviously, that doesn't like the Affordable Care Act.
Well, yes. And let me just highlight something Tammy said, that a lot of people aren't going to the hospital now to get uncompensated care. And that's meant that the premiums for most Americans are gone up a lot more slowly than they have in the past. That has been a big plus for everybody, the Affordable Care Act. And I am optimistic. I think the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. I can't speak about every other state, but I could say that with the leadership of people like Senator Mathias, we're going to protect it here in Maryland.
What about you, Senator? Are you optimistic?
I'm optimistic.
Are you always an optimist?
I don't know. I'm not always an optimist, but I'm a realist, and we look for solutions. Clearly, look, let's look at this. You've already heard people came together on that vote again this summer in a bipartisan way. It was both parties that said, nobody said this is a perfect bill, and we're looking for amendments and solutions going forward. So I am very optimistic. And if you turn around and you look, really the surging premiums are in the individual market. And if we can figure out a way how we can protect those folks in that individual market and move forward and keep this coverage so that you don't have this uncompensated care when people go to the emergency room and our providers, which are critically important so much in a rural area, even more so that we have our coverage, but we have our health care providers. So I think it's very important. And not only am I optimistic, I'm wholly committed to making sure this works.
Like Senator Mathias said, and he's worked very hard, the individual mandate goes away, everybody's insurance goes up. Every Marylander is going to be affected, and I think he is one of those people that can make sure that that doesn't happen.
We have been talking this past half hour about the new Maryland law against price gouging for generic and off-patent brand name drugs. Joining us were State Senator Jim Mathias, Vince DeMarco, president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative, and Tammy Bresnahan with AARP. They all spoke at a forum earlier this week in Salisbury. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.